Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to give you some advice for Mother's Day. When you hear the name Sterling, you might think of a classic shave, but this Mother's Day, we're looking at the bigger picture. This year, treat mom to the luxury she deserves with Sterling's full line of personal care items. We're talking about more than just soap. We're talking about rich body lotions, nourishing lip balms, and essential oils that turn any room into a sanctuary. From their handmade bath soaps to their long-lasting shampoo and conditioner bars, Sterling uses natural ingredients like shea butter and tallow for a quality you can feel. Give her an artisan experience this Mother's Day by heading to sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And as we try to do each week, we bring in a specialist, an archaeologist that's dusting off the sands of time and finding some treasures of football. And his name is Timothy B. Brown of FootballArchaeology.com. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Darren, thank you. Thank you. And since we're talking about the Brits, I wish I would have thought about this before I published the tidbit, but the title should have been Keep Calm and Carry On.
Keep Calm and Carry On. That is a very famous logo from history. Yeah. Kind of talk about.
But and, kind of carry the ball.
Yeah, very good. Very clever. Yeah,
but a little late.
That's all right though. But you did have a title to this, what inspired this conversation we're having today, on a tidbit that you titled "That Time the Brits Wanted Us to Give Up Football." So, boy, those dirty Brits! Why would they want us to give up football, Tim?
Those sons of guns. Well, so actually, before talking about what I wrote, just in the past couple of days, for a different reason, I ended up going back to Walter Camp's American Football, which he published in 1891. And I'll just, tell people it's available for free. You can download it for free out there on our wonderful interwebs. I was looking at some of that again, and he really does a great job, opening paragraphs of covering some of this period, this whole thing that I'm talking about. Not so much, he doesn't go into this whole British thing, but just what football looked like when in 1876 and then into the early 80s. So he just does a real nice job of kind of telling you kind of the story and how it evolved in the early years. So, I've told this story a bunch of times, but early rugby was a vastly different game than today. It was mostly, they had 15 guys on the field, and it was almost solely a kicking game. Carrying the ball was allowed, but you pretty much, the whole game was like a big scrum where they were trying to kick it forward through the other team. And so the odd thing was that if you could kick it through the other team's front line, then one of their backs could pick it up and toss it to somebody else and run with it. And so during that whole thing, the Americans basically decided they liked the game better. The more you could carry the ball, the better, right? So they started doing things like kind of letting the ball get kicked through their side so that one of their backs could pick it up and run with it. But even then, that was still a little bit too chancy for them. So then they started, when they went to the system of downs in 1880, then they had the snapback. Or I shouldn't say the system of downs, system of possession in 1880. That's when they started snapping back with the foot, what you see in rugby now, but that, kind of, I think, developed in American football more than in rugby. So anyways, we were doing this, and then in 1882, they also went to the system of downs because Princeton, those sneaky sons of guns, they had developed a thing where, American football, the 1880 rules gave one team possession or the other. but it didn't have any mechanism to force them to give up the ball. So Princeton just basically played, they stalled the whole time, you know, like for a whole half, they just stalled. And, you know, once they got the ball and, you know, they never gave up the ball to the other side.
So that's what they called the block game, correct?
The block, exactly. Okay. And so it was boring as snot, and they changed the rule in 82 to require, you know, so you, that's when the system of downs came in. You only had, you had three downs to make 5 yards or to lose 10, I think it was at the time. So anyways, as it turned out, there were a couple of British guys in New York who had watched a couple of American college games in 1881, and they thought it was boring as hell. Now, the Americans did too, which is why they put in the, you know, the rule, like, you know, the rule of downs. And so these Brits are looking at Americans bastardizing their, you know, wonderful game of rugby. And so they form a team in early in January of 82, you know, in New York City, and they start practicing among themselves and playing, you know, scrimmage games, and they're trying to find people to play. And one of the things that they did, you know, their initial plans were like, we're going to be playing, you know, Yale and Harvard and blah, blah, blah. And so they end up inviting representatives from Yale, Harvard, and Princeton to a lunch or dinner in like April of 82. And they basically, you know, gave them a proposal to get rid of all these American changes to the game and have them just play rugby union rules. And the Americans were like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, we like our, the way we like the way we've modified the game more than what you guys, the way you guys play. And as it turns out, you know, rugby did in fact evolve more along the lines of how the Americans were playing in the 80s, maybe even into the 90s. You know, I mean, because picking up and carrying the ball and snapping back with foot, you know, became, you know, the nature of the game. So it's just kind of funny that these guys, they continued practicing and they were trying to play games, and then they couldn't find any, the American college teams were like, we're not playing you guys, you know. And so they were able to arrange a game with the Britannias, a rugby team from up in Montreal, and they came down and played two games in New York City in like November of 82. And then, I mean, best as I can tell, the you know, this, the British Football Club, which is what they were called, just dissolved after that. So they didn't last long, but they, you know, they made an attempt to, you know, get the Americans to do things the right way and play rugby union rules, and and they basically said, nah, you can take that stuff and put it where the British Empire sun does not shine.
It's really amazing how you go fast forward, you know, 140 some years. And now, you know, the NFL is one of the biggest sporting events when they have games over in Great Britain and other places throughout Europe. So it's a, I guess it must have evolved all right. Maybe these guys would look different now.
You know, it's an interesting thing though. Like I'm blanking on his name right now and his site, but there's a guy that I follow. He's a, I believe he's in Germany, maybe he's in Netherlands, but anyways, he had a really interesting article a while back that, he was basically arguing that while there's this sense that football is really popular in Europe and some other places, it's still pretty much of a niche thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I compare it, I mean, rugby is much more popular in North America, especially Canada, but you know, rugby's, I should say hockey is, you know, like people in Wyoming don't care about hockey. Right. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you're in some of the northern cities and now, you know, southern cities, you know, it's a bigger deal, but you know, I mean, I didn't grow up watching hockey, you know, it just, even though I grew up in Wisconsin, it just wasn't a big deal back then. So anyways, so his argument is it gets, you know, they get good crowds and everything, but it, these are people who follow football already. And so I actually think that part of the strategy for, you know, the NFL promoting touch football is to get more people into football generally, not necessarily tackle. You know, it's a, because you don't need a bunch of equipment to play touch football. You know, right. You don't need anywhere near the coaching and the, you know, I mean, sure, at the high levels probably you do, but, you know, it's just, I mean, how many times did you go out, you know, at the park or somebody's backyard and play touch football or tackle football, just, but, you know, kids out there playing.
Yeah, we were stupid enough to play on frozen streets here in Erie during the wintertime.
Yeah.
I'd look at it now, I'm like, why did I do that? That's crazy.
Football in a foot or two of snow is better than any kind of football there is.
Well, you play on the plowed streets where there's like an inch, 2 inches thick of ice, you know, that's just dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. You get home eating, you get salt all over your body. Right. Yeah. So anyways, I think that the whole touch football thing will help football to become more, you know, a little bit more mainstream elsewhere in the world. And it removes a lot of the size issues that, you know, it's more like 7-on-7, right? I mean, so you don't need a bunch of big bulky linemen, you know,
You'd be amazed, though. I just had a podcast interview just a few months ago with a gentleman from Estonia, and they have semi-professional teams in Estonia that are playing semi-professional teams from Russia, which is, I guess, nearby the border.
Yeah.
So if they have semi-professional, these guys are making some money. Somebody's paying some money to see these folks play. It's amazing how it's a grassroots effort is popping up sort of, you know, 120 years behind where we are.
I get that. And like, you know, I've watched in the past year, I've watched a championship game in Japan, in England. And I think I watched one for Finland recently. You know,
India has a big league.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They have a professional football league in India.
So, I mean, so anyways, yeah, I mean, I get it, but it's still not, I don't think it's quite the same thing as, in terms of just the depth of interest that you have here and in Canada. But, you know, I mean, like the NFL draft, you know, they had all these people from Mexico and from all over the world, you know, announcing the picks and, you know, doing all that. I think it's great. You know, I'm perfectly happy that they're doing it, but I view touch as a tactic to help spread the word.
Yeah. To help the NFL make more money. Of course it is. They're quite the marketing machine. You're quite the marketing machine yourself of, you know, bringing up some of these topics of American football history that, most of us have never heard of before. Most of us never really even thought about before, but you're bringing them to light again and, resuscitating them to our consciousness. And we appreciate that in your tidbits. Maybe you could tell folks where they can find more of your work.
Sure. Just go to footballarchaeology.com. It's a Substack site. You can subscribe, follow, or just bookmark. You know, I've also got a bunch of books that I sell on Amazon, but you know, you can also get them directly through me if, you know, for people who prefer not to use that route. That's kind of any and all of those are ways to get some football archaeology background.
Tim, we sure appreciate the work that you do and coming on here and sharing it with us each week. And we'd love to talk to you again 7 days from now.
It's a pleasure every time. So we'll see you then.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network. your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Gridiron, Japan!
Hello, Sports History Network listeners. I'm Greg St. James, and I'm inviting you to take a journey with me across the Pacific with Gridiron Japan Radio. I'm joined by a powerhouse team to bring you the best of football here in the land of the rising sun. We've got John Gunning of Inside Sport Japan and the Japan Times, star international and ex-league quarterback Aaron Ellis, and we're thrilled to welcome the new duo from the newly relaunched From the 55-Yard Line podcast, which is now Gridiron America Radio, co-host Dave Selinsky and Mike Tackett. We cover the Japanese X-League as well as the college game and interview the players and coaches who are making a splash here on the far side of the world. Subscribe today and help us celebrate the global game.